This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. People of a certain age got used to thinking of the U.S. Supreme Court as a protector of civil rights, from school desegregation in Brown versus Board to the case of Ernesto Miranda, which requires police to warn people that they have the right to remain silent. But a new book argues that period of progress was an aberration, that most of the court's record on race is more distressing and disgraceful. And while this is a book of history, it is very much relevant to the present day, up to and including last night's unsigned 5-4 ruling that effectively allows the state of Texas to ban most abortions. The book is called Justice Deferred, Race and the Supreme Court. One of the authors is Orville Vernon Burton. He's got two of those fantastically complicated titles that successful professors tend to acquire. He's the Judge Matthew J. Perry Jr. Distinguished Professor of History at Clemson University. And of interest to our listeners in Illinois, he's also Emeritus University Scholar and Professor of History at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Professor Burton, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for discussing our book.
The other author of Justice Deferred is Armand Derfner. He's a civil rights attorney who's argued multiple cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, here he is back in 1975, arguing that Richmond, Virginia had illegally expanded the city limits in order to dilute the black vote.
And in fact, in Richmond, what we have is a situation where the growth of black voting strength, the overcoming by black voters of the history of discrimination against them, which occurred as the 60s grew on, and especially with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, was suddenly aborted in 1969, actually.
So Armand Derfner, from 1975 to 2021, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here as well.
Happy to be here, and interesting to hear that piece of history from me.
Listeners, as ever, we invite you to join our conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. Vernon, I want to begin with you. Like a lot of contemporary histories of America, your book begins in 1619, which is when a ship arrived in the ironically named Point Comfort, Virginia, delivering a cargo of 20 enslaved Africans. This is a century and a half, almost two centuries, before there was even a U.S. Supreme Court. Why begin this story during the colonial period?
Well, the book is a study of race in America, and it's a study of race through the lens of the Supreme Court. And I think it's interesting, while no one had done this book before, I don't think, now I may be unfair, any historian could have done it. I don't believe any law professor could have done it. And what we've done is something unique, I think, and that is we've taken law and history and put them together in a comprehensive way. That is, before the founding of the United States, before the Constitution, before the Supreme Court, right up, I mean, into the present day. We were writing in page proof, still having to pay Harvard for that, just as Amy Comey Barrett was being nominated, and we even predicted the recent Brnovich case, which came out of Arizona on voting rights. So that's why we wanted to look at race and how race has been influenced. And one of the things we argue, and I think people don't understand this, is that we have had 12 generations, literally, of African-Americans in particular, but other minorities as well. But African-Americans have had 12 generations in which the law has worked against them, has actually been written and enforced to disadvantage them, not just slavery, but right on up and through. And only the last two generations of U.S. history have, in fact, we started to move toward equality.
And Armand Derfner, one of the other things that you talk about with regard to these, you know, in the colonial period, they were slave codes, black codes, as they were known at the time. This was in the law, right? Not only regulating the behavior of enslaved people, but also the behavior of the majority white population and how they interacted. And you say, over time, we've forgotten the line in the book that's jumped out at me. The mind retains the color line, but forgets that it was created by the web of laws. Why is it important to remember that this was legal and not just something in the hearts of everyday people?
We call it a national amnesia. And it's important because what would happen in those days stays around. In other words, things today are the product of what happened then. And we also have a quote from George Orwell, who says, "The past was erased, the erasure was forgotten, the lie became the truth." And so for here's a good example. Some people think, and in fact, some Supreme Court justices say, well, these white suburbs, they just happen by themselves. Well, that's not so. The suburbs became white or grew up as white because there were laws keeping African Americans out, other minorities as well. There were restrictive covenants. The federal government poured billions and billions of dollars into the Federal Housing Administration, which had rules that said segregation is what you need. We had redlining by federal agencies. So it was the federal government, state government. They created these white suburbs, and that's what we have today. So the present grows out of the past, and we wanted to show that, not just tell it. My sons are writers, and they say what we have to do is don't tell people, show them. So that's why we've gone through in such detail about some of these things that have happened in the past, so people can see for themselves where we are today grows out of where we used to be.
Yeah, the past definitely connects to where we are today. The past is not done with us yet. We need to take a break here for our member stations. I want to once again invite our listeners to join our conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. If you have a question for our guests or a perspective on the U.S. Supreme Court and racial justice, give us a call. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. When we return, we're going to continue our discussion with Professor Vernon Burton, attorney Armand Derfner. They're the co-authors of the book Justice Deferred, Race and the Supreme Court. That's coming up after a short break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Professor Orville Vernon Burton and attorney Armand Derfner. They're the co-authors of the new book, Justice Deferred, Race and the Supreme Court. It looks at the history of race and the Supreme Court over the centuries and argues that the period of racial progress that a lot of us are familiar with and learn about in school from Brown versus Board through the next few decades until the early 1970s, that was something of an aberration in the court's history, and that the rest of the court's history on race is much less distinguished. And Vernon, I want to ask you, you focus on the changes that the made to the Constitution around the time of the Civil War. And you say they're so significant that the founders should be thought not only to include Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton, but also Lincoln, Douglas, Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, members of Congress at the time. How was the Constitution radically transformed at that time?
Well, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment has been called a second founding by historian Eric Foner. I like to say that they are the legacy of Abraham Lincoln, the Illinois, and who becomes the 16th president, and that literally he took our mission statement, which is the Declaration of Independence, and put it into our rule book, the Constitution. And it really changed the Constitution itself in extraordinary ways. You know, before that, almost all the rights were reserved to the states. And then it says that the federal government has the positive power to do these things. In other words, it was sort of Lincoln changed it from negative liberty to positive liberty, to use Isaiah Berlin's ways. And one of the issues that we dealt with is that it was very hard or difficult, or at least they chose not to, not all of them, but some of the justices could not make that transition from states having the powers to regulate and do and deferring to what we would call federalism then, deferring to the states, letting them have their way, even on issues such as voting and things, as long as they could find ways not to say that we are disfranchising or segregating Black people, but to say that, do it in words that were neutral. In other words, the most one that people are familiar would be poll tax, literacy laws, things like that.
And Armand Derfner, why do you think the justices on the court in that period after the Civil War worked so hard to undermine the new constitutional amendments and the laws aimed at, you know, Reconstruction?
It is a mystery. It's a mystery because, in fact, most of the justices in those days were appointed by Abraham Lincoln and U.S. Grant. And so they came on with certainly with sympathy for the newly freed people. There were a couple on who were, frankly, members of the Democratic Party at that time and probably were active racists, but only a couple of them. I think it's just that if I had to name one factor, I'd say these are justices who lived their whole lives and whole careers, just like Vernon just said, with one system in which the federal government had very little power, the states were in charge, and they could not get used to the idea that it was going to be different. Actually, up into the New Deal days, the Supreme Court was still on the idea that the states did everything and the federal government did nothing. So we are still suffering from, in a sense, what the first rollout of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in the late 19th century was a really awful one. What the Warren Court did and the other courts in the mid-20th century was, in a sense, to do some of that over. And so that's where we've had some progress. But I think basically people got used to a certain way and we're still suffering from that.
I'm glad you mentioned the Warren Court. And Vernon, let me ask you about that. The book raises a number of tantalizing what-if questions, near hits and misses. And, you know, the Warren Court is synonymous with at least some progress on civil rights, greater respect for people accused of crimes. But Earl Warren almost did not become Chief Justice. Can you talk about, you know, what happened there and what the consequences would be if there had not been a Warren Court, and how that fits into this broader idea that, you know, the Supreme Court should be viewed with some skepticism as a sort of guarantor of liberty and civil rights?
Yeah, and in fact, you could go even further back. You would not have guessed that Warren would be the great justice that he was on his, there were some hints on his record as a California politician and governor of California with some of the issues that had arisen before that. But it was a recess appointment. And in fact, if Brown v. Board had come to the court and the decision had been made when he was on, the judge, the recess time, there's no way, I believe, that he would have possibly been confirmed by the court at that time. It was a very close call. Of course, Eisenhower sort of promised disappointment, but he had not intended, I think, for him to be the Chief Justice initially. So it's a backstory there that's just fascinating. And there's so many what ifs there. And let me just add one other that is one of my things about the book, that we find so many irony and contradiction. You know, during the Warren Court, when of course the great Thurgood Marshall, who worked for the NAACP and the LDF, he wins almost every case against incredible odds when he's arguing against the Supreme Court. In fact, that we have one notion about when his head just snaps back when he hears the decision because no one expected it, and that Brown v. Board was unanimous. And then when he gets on the court, he finds himself on the losing side of almost all of the decisions for the last part of his life.
Yeah, I love that moment in the book, and a silent nod or a slightly imperceptible, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but a nod from the Kentucky justice who is thought to be the staunch Southerner who would go for the segregationist ideas.
And it is very important that it was Earl Warren who goes and gets this unanimous opinion. I mean, he worked behind the scenes to do this, understanding the importance of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that underscores maybe the danger of something you hear today of putting faith in one person in on the court, right? And I've heard it said that liberal and progressive people are mistaken when they put a lot of hope in judicial decision making, and thus are maybe mistaken in putting so much effort into shaping the courts through appointments. I think the argument here is that courts are fundamentally conservative institutions, small c conservative, and so liberal energy ought to be put into the legislative process and perhaps even stripping the courts of jurisdiction on some issues. Armand Derfner, I wonder, what do you make of those arguments?
I think it is true that you can't count on the courts too much. In fact, I think my generation, I went to college and law school in the 50s and 60s in the Warren court days. And we had a feeling that the courts could do a lot. And maybe we got lulled into being unprepared for what has happened in recent times when the court is doing so much to move backwards. In fact, the real problem today is that for the first time in history, I think, the court of nowadays is not just looking backward, but is out of step. I think the American people, by and large, it's hard to generalize about a whole country more than 300 million people, but I think by and large, the American people are in tune with progress, including racial progress. I think the court today is out of step with that, and it's the chance of who gets to appoint them. You know, the Republicans invented this notion in 2016 that you shouldn't approve a new justice in the last year of a president. And then when it along came 2020, and they said, not just the last year, we'll put somebody in the court in the last 2 weeks of a term. So it's there are all kinds of coincidences, and they all play a part. But you're right. Most of the coincidences, or more of the coincidences, seem to be against the idea of racial progress.
If you're just joining us, I was just going to take a moment to reintroduce for our listeners. If you're just tuning in, it's the 21st. We're speaking with Armand Derfner and Vernon Burton. They're the co-authors of Justice Deferred, Race in the Supreme Court. And Vernon, go ahead. You were trying to get
Brian,
in.
Brian, it just reminded me, since we've spoken of Thurgood Marshall and Armand, and you asked the question about the importance of politics. There are three branches of government, but we too often forget, of course, that the American presidency is a winner-take-all, and that they get to appoint these justices for life, both the Supreme Court and federal. But one of the scenes that I can hardly talk about without breaking up is so emotional to me, is a great example is the Reagan Revolution in 1980, when Thurgood Marshall and his friend William Brennan come together at the end. And when Thurgood Marshall was up for the Supreme Court nomination, Strom Thurmond of South Carolina just gave him a horrible time. You know, are you a communist, all this? And so Brennan comes up to Marshall, and you have to envision these two. Thurgood Marshall is a giant of a man. Brennan is a small little fellow. And he says, can it be true that instead of Ted Kennedy, who was a great supporter of civil rights, that Strom Thurmond is now going to be the chair of the Judiciary Committee? And Thurgood Marshall said yes. He puts his arm around Brennan, and these two old warriors sort of walk off for their last battles. But to me, that's just so symbolic of the role politics plays in the judicial system.
Yeah, and there are a number, we don't have time to get into them, but even as now, there are some progressives who want to change the structure of the court, change the number of justices, perhaps, in retaliation for that 2016 incident where Justice Scalia's vacancy was held open for almost a year so that a Republican president could fill that vacancy. There are times when the court, the number of justices on the court have been changed for political reasons in the past to deprive successive presidents of the ability to fill those vacancies. But as I said, we don't have much time. I want to maybe, as we're coming to the end of our conversation, Armand, ask you, there's disagreement today over how much, you know, racial progress has been made and whether the laws that are on the books now, which are purportedly colorblind, you know, people can dust their hands and say we're done, or you look at outcomes and say, well, clearly there is still discrimination. Clearly, there's still inequality of income, of wealth, of health outcomes, whatever you want to say. And it's this question of interpreting cases today. Do you look at the results of a law or do you look at the intent of a law? Can you talk about that divide?
That is one of the great ironies. And we devote a whole chapter to this whole question of purpose versus effect. And that is what has come to be. Purpose would be okay if it's possible to prove. Part of the problem is the Supreme Court in the last couple of years, last 3 years, has made it almost impossible to prove discriminatory purpose. So that's one way in which a rule, having to prove discriminatory purpose, made it harder to begin with. But then the Supreme Court at that time, back in the Burger Court, issued a rule called the Arlington Heights Rule, making it possible to prove purpose. The court in the last 3 years has almost dismantled the Arlington Heights Rule. So it's not just that they're saying purpose has to be proved, which is hard, but they're also putting a double whammy on by saying, and we're going to make it almost impossible to prove purpose. So it's become a device, a really political device, by which this court is really putting its thumb on the scale very much against the civil rights of racial minorities.
The book is called Justice Deferred, Race and the Supreme Court. The authors are Armand Derfner and Orville Vernon Burton. Armand is an attorney. Vernon Burton is a professor at Clemson University and an emeritus university scholar and professor from the University of Illinois. Vernon Burton, Armand Derfner, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Really an honor.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. I do want to mention next week we're going to be looking back. We're coming up on the 20-year anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. And we're going to be looking back and want to hear from listeners, what are your memories of 9/11? Even if you were not in New York or Washington, if you were here in Illinois, what do you remember about that day? For so many of us, it was a day that we will never forget. There's a new generation coming up now, though, for whom these events are something they learn about in the history books. Go to our website. You can send us an email, voice memo, leave us a voicemail. That's all on our website, 21stshow.org. We'd love to hear from you about your memories of the tragic events of 9/11. And that is all the time we have for this week. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer. And our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skolark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.